private corporations interfering in public discourse and speech?
Right, absolutely. And I think some people have been had if they think that Silicon Valley is on their side. So, yeah, Silicon Valley backs the DNC to an extent, and they're backing the Biden administration, obviously, over the opposition. But it's worth pointing out that Silicon Valley has fused with the national security state. Former CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt, is running the modernization policy, not just for the U.S. military, but for the U.S. intelligence community through something he chairs called the National Security Commission on AI, that is stuffed with Silicon Valley representatives. The U.S. military's Defense Innovation Unit for most of 2020 was run by a Silicon Valley executive, not a member of the military, even though it's part of the military. And a lot of these Silicon Valley firms, were Google included, were originally started with money from InQtel, which is the CIA's venture capital firm. And a lot of these companies double as contractors to the U.S. military or to U.S. intelligence. So to really treat them as just a solely private entity at this point, I think, is actually misguided. We really need to treat them as basically an extension of the U.S. national security state that with a lot of these companies ended up creating them. And so at that point, when you realize the line, how the line has blurred between Silicon Valley and the government, it really becomes state censorship. And to think that wouldn't be used against people of any political movement is very naive, especially when you consider that perhaps for now, this war on domestic terror, the boogeyman, are people on the far right, but they've set it up so that there is now the Antifa boogeyman that it will be used to target people on the left whenever convenient for the establishment, and they will switch it whenever they see fit. And the people that are feeling oppressed now by this expansion will be like, yeah, those are the real terrorists, Antifa, and then we'll be cheering it on the other side. I mean, it's textbook divide and conquer, and if we don't see through this ruse quickly, the United States is in very deep trouble.
What do you think is the antidote? How can we mitigate this in terms of working class movements, leftists, anti-imperialists? What can we do not just to oppose these potential new domestic terror laws, but this unholy alliance between big tech and the national security state?
Well, I think we need to realize that our enemy isn't the person with the wrong lawn sign or necessarily a MAGA hat that's just around us in our communities. This is a class war, ultimately, what's going on right now, which is really the elite trying to create this giant neo-feudal underclass. And what we're having is this fusion of major private companies like Silicon Valley, for example, with the state that a lot of leftists would define as corporatism. And that is something that the Biden administration fundamentally represents. And so, you know, our enemy aren't our neighbors and things like that. And because of the economic crisis and all of this stuff, we need our communities more than ever. And we need to keep in mind who the real enemy is in a lot of cases, and who is really responsible for a lot of the suffering that's going on right now, both in the U.S. and abroad, and really keep our eye on that we are being played. Who is dividing and conquering us? Who is benefiting from this scenario? We need to start asking those questions and taking a look at who's pulling the strings of all of this and who's set to benefit. Because if we don't do something now, this war on domestic terror apparatus is going to be so pervasive and very difficult to, it will make it very difficult to organize in the future. And so really the time to do that is now. And that may, you know, require reaching across the aisle to people we don't necessarily agree with, but the leftist billionaires and the right-wing billionaires at the top are all working together against us. So it's about time that people, you know, in the class that they see as, you know, this giant underclass, that we start working together to, you know, stop this system from being implemented.
Now, last week, Donald Trump was impeached again, becoming the first president in U.S. history to be impeached twice. The first time in 2019, he was impeached over the phone call he made to the Ukrainian president, and now, supposedly, over high crimes and misdemeanors. In both cases, the articles of impeachment introduced by the House never included Trump's violations of the Emoluments Clause and Trump profiting while in office, receiving foreign dignitaries at his privately owned hotels on a regular basis, or even making his own military take pit stops to stay at his private resorts in Scotland. The articles of impeachment never included anything about the wars of aggression, about Trump continuing to support the Saudi-led genocide in Yemen, or his acts of terrorism against Iran and Venezuela and other countries. If they really wanted to, the Democrats could have impeached him from day one for violating his oath to office and the Constitution. However, now all of a sudden, Democrats are animate and up in arms and have spent the last week railing about how Trump is an existential threat and democracy is under attack and the republic is imperiled. Quick, we have to get rid of him, they say. And yet, they did nothing for years. The U.S. political establishment is completely fine with white supremacy, fascist coups, insurrections, as long as they advance the goal of their empire and make a lot of money for them and their friends in the private sector. This is the harsh reality that many have yet to grasp. But for the rest of the world, this has always been obvious. And that very building where these riots took place, the U.S. Capitol, has always represented imperialism, oppression, war, and destruction. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
www.parstoday.com/en. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight. A large group of world scientists, including five Nobel laureates, warned a changing climate, including more severe floods and droughts, could depress growth in global food production by up to 30% by 2050. Whilst rising seas and greater storm surges could destroy urban economies and force hundreds of millions of coastal dwellers from their homes. We now present you an article written by Megan Rowling. The piece is titled, Scientists Warn Step Up Adaptation to Climate Change Now or Risk Enormous Toll. The article has been published by the Reuters news agency. Please stay with us for more of Megan Rowling's article. More than 3,000 scientists recently called for a far bigger global push to protect people and nature from the effects of a heating planet, even as researchers estimated funding to adapt to climate change has dropped because of the COVID-19 pandemic. In a statement, the scientists, including five Nobel laureates, warned that a failure to respond to rising climate risks as governments try to revive their economies from the coronavirus pandemic would have severe consequences, especially for the poorest countries. The scientists from nearly 120 countries wrote ahead of a global summit on adaptation in coming days, unless we step up and adapt now, the results will be increasing poverty, increasing water shortages, agricultural losses, and soaring levels of migration with an enormous toll on human life. They noted a change in climate, including more severe floods and droughts, could depress growth in global food production by up to 30% by 2050. While rising seas and greater storm surges would destroy urban economies and force hundreds of millions of coastal dwellers from their homes. They said to avoid that, major new efforts are needed to conserve nature, including forests, wetlands, and coral reefs, as is a planning revolution to make cities, transport, energy, and other infrastructure safer from climate shocks. They added better education, especially for girls, and redeployment of the world's existing financial resources would enable adaptation under massive scale required. Former United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who chairs the Global Center on Adaptation, which is organizing the summit with the Dutch government, said, "We must remember there is no vaccination for our changing climate." Ban Ki-moon told journalists, building resilience to climate impacts is not a nice to have, it is a must if we are to live in a sustainable and secure world. Ban Ki-moon noted alongside the COVID-19 pandemic, last year saw surging heat, intensifying drought and rampant wildfires, adding that the pandemic might have been avoided if the world had acted earlier to protect nature and prevent climate change. Ban Ki-moon said whilst 2021 will be defined by efforts to recover from the COVID-19 pandemic, the centuries ahead will be defined by how green the recovery is. But a Global Center for Adaptation report assessing global progress on adaptation issued recently cited research showing government pandemic stimulus measures that support fossil fuels and high carbon activities outnumbered green initiatives by up to 4-1. It also flagged a new estimate from the Climate Policy Initiative that finance for adaptation is likely to have fallen, though by less than 10% in 2020, as the pandemic hit budgets hard. A United Nations report said recently that funding was already falling far short of needs before the COVID-19 crisis, with an annual average of $30 billion available for adaptation in 2017-2018. Estimates of the cost of adapting to climate change vary widely, but the Climate Policy Initiative and the Global Center on Adaptation said adaptation finance needed to increase by between 5- and 10-fold from its current levels. Only about 5% of all climate finance goes to adapting to more extreme weather and rising seas. The United Nations Secretary General and others have called for that share to be raised to half, especially in financial support for poorer countries. Patrick Verkuyen, the Chief Executive Officer of the Rotterdam-based Global Center on Adaptation, described climate change adaptation as a casualty of the pandemic. He said adaptation needs to accelerate, but this acceleration is not happening fast enough. In fact, it's even slowing down. The Global Center on Adaptation report noted, last year, development banks, major sources of climate finance, prioritized coronavirus rescue packages that help developing nations deal with pressures on their health services and face economic downturns. Meanwhile, the pandemic put a brake on many adaptation projects as construction work was halted by lockdowns and supply chain disruptions, meant inputs like seeds, tools, and technical expertise were not delivered on time. Patrick Verkuyen, the Chief Executive Officer of Rotterdam-based Global Center on Adaptation, said the shortfall in action and financing for adaptation could be turned around if decision makers ensure the trillions of dollars they are preparing to spend on boosting their economies are not aimed at building climate resistance. He told the Thomson Reuters Foundation, "This is now the time to have a step change on adaptation investments." The Global Center on Adaptation and a statement from scientists called for a wholesale rethink of financial and business incentives, which today largely fail to reflect longer-term risks. They said the potential social and economic benefits of managing threats better also deserve more attention. A 2019 Global Center on Adaptation report estimated that investing $1.8 trillion in weather early warning systems, climate-resilient infrastructure, improved dryland agriculture, mangrove protection and water security could generate as much as $7.1 trillion in total net benefits. Patrick Verkuyen, the Chief Executive Officer of the Global Center on Adaptation, emphasized the best way to protect people from worsening extreme weather and rising seas was to slash climate heating emissions to meet the globally agreed warming limits in the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. He said, "But even if governments and businesses ramp up renewable energy and energy efficiency fast enough to do that, we still have a massive investment need in adaptation, as already unavoidable climate change impacts unfold. He added, improving adaptation is not defeat, it's simply defense.
Around the World with Reporters.
The number of people sleeping on the streets at night across the European Union is growing by the day amid the pandemic. Welfare systems are under enormous strain. We have been speaking to one homeless man in Brussels who is finding it difficult to acquire emergency accommodation.
It's very hard in the cold, in the winter. It's very hard to feel good, to find somewhere. It's very difficult.
A debate on the worsening social crisis in the EU resulting from COVID-19 has been held in the European Parliament.
We have a problem here. The slow, sluggish bureaucracy of the European Union is not compatible with emergencies like the one we face today.
Governments in the EU are being urged to submit pandemic recovery plans to the European Commission so that €750 billion in available funding can be released without any further delay.
Millions of people lost already their jobs, and they are mainly the low-skilled, the low-paid workers, the temporary workers, the young on precarious work.
The European Parliament debate was told the EU social crisis could last for many years unless action is taken to save economies.
Thousands of businesses have temporarily or permanently closed. Millions of Europeans have lost their jobs and livelihoods.
Many EU legislators say the 27-country bloc's vaccination programme is being delivered too slowly. To make matters worse, experts in the UK are suggesting the new variant of COVID-19, discovered last year in England, might be more deadly than previously thought. EU officials are concerned new variants of the disease might be resistant to approved vaccines and vaccines awaiting approval. With that comes obvious health concerns, but also incredible economic uncertainty. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The latest report by the National Bureau of Statistics is that has found that large swaths of mostly young and highly educated Italians have continued to move abroad in search of working opportunities. Italy's young workers have been living for decades. However, the report has highlighted that over 300,000 Italians aged 18 to 39 emigrated to neighboring European countries and overseas between 2015 and 2019, up 33% compared to 2014. One in three of them were graduates.
These figures show that young Italians, particularly from the rich north, choose to leave the country because the labor market doesn't offer them any prospects. This is why young people from the depressed Italy south continue to emigrate to northern cities. We are calling on the government to invest more in the youth, in its recovery and resilience plan, the investment project using European Union funds to counter the effect of the pandemic.
Youth unemployment level in Italy stands at about 40%. Furthermore, 3 out of 10 Italians between 18 and 24 years of age are not in employment, education or training, the third highest percentage among OECD countries.
A recent study by the European Commission has found that Italy, along with Poland and Romania, is among the European countries that send the most workers abroad. This brain drain costs Italy an estimated €14 billion every year.
It's an inconceivable waste. Once trained through our school system, our young Italians offer their skills to foreign countries. It's true, our labor market is stagnant, but it must be said that quite often the system does not reward merit.
Successive Italian governments had long tried attracting back talented workers with tax breaks, with no success. However, a counter-exodus of the brain drain seems to be underway since the start of the pandemic. Data from Italy's foreign ministry shows that in 2020, the number of young Italians returning home increased about 20% over the previous year. Max Civili, Rome.
A London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission made a plea with Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari, reminding the illegal grounds on which top cleric Sheikh Zazaki and his wife were being kept in prison. Simultaneously, the Islamic Human Rights Commission has also written to the United Nations asking the international body to exert pressure on Nigeria to do the same. Lawyer to the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, expressed shock that 7 days after testing positive to COVID-19, Zazaki's wife, Zinat, is yet to be hospitalized. Also in a press conference, the Islamic movement in Nigeria said that keeping Malama Zinat in Kaduna prison without hospitalization has violated the known guidelines and protocols for the prevention of the spread of COVID-19.
The task force for the COVID-19 pandemic, they went around, even sharing, distributing contacts, that whenever you see somebody affected, you should call them, they will come and immediately evacuate such a person for treatment. But that of Mala Mazina, she's there for 7 days, till today, she's still in the prison custody.
In December 2015, security forces attacked Zazaki's house and worship center, killing over 340 of his supporters and 3 of his biological children. The Islamic movement in Nigeria said it will continue to demand justice for Sheikh Zazaki and his wife.
We call on the masses to join us in calling for justice. We call on the relevant authorities to respect the law of the land and immediately and unconditionally release the corpse, as court has ordered for their immediate release.
Zazaki's son, Muhammad, said up to now, his mother, Zinat, is still in Kaduna prison and is yet to be hospitalized. The Islamic movement in Nigeria and Zazaki's son are both calling on the authorities to ensure that she receives proper medical care and to release Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife with immediate effect. Ranjim Abdullahi, Abuja.
Travel agents in 13 different countries should get ready for a rush of customers. The United States has finally lifted its shockingly xenophobic and unprecedented travel ban. Iran was one of 6 other Muslim-majority nations which were primarily targeted, which caused ex-President Donald Trump's executive order to become called the Muslim travel ban, informally and infamously. New President Joe Biden ended the ban on his first day in office. The bigotry lasted 4 years, and the damage to American citizens, countless non-Americans, and America's image cannot be overestimated.
The real shame in this is not simply turning our back on, America's tradition of not judging people on the basis of their religion or our constitutional prohibition against that. But what's really, troubling about this is that we have gone through this process where family members have not been able to be together with loved ones.
Husbands and wives have been kept apart for years. Grandparents passed away without seeing their newborn grandchildren. Weddings, graduations, birthdays, funerals, jobs, business deals, educational exchanges. The accumulation of grief and difficulty caused by the Islamophobic ban is appalling. In many ways, the ban backfired, because it emphatically demonstrated the scope and reach of state-sponsored Islamophobia, something which had been routinely denied by the right and the left, not only in the United States, but across the West.
It's really going to require that we go through the hard work of actually implementing policies, not just in travel, but in other ways, that fight against Islamophobia, because we know that it has been a feature in our society, you know, certainly for the last 30 years, but even long before that.
The ban led to doctor shortages in a United States which would soon be unable to handle the coronavirus pandemic. It also put a pause on the so-called brain drain, which allows America to stay near the forefront of science and technology. Trump's dehumanizing of Muslims followed years of scapegoating in order to rationalize the wars across the Muslim world started by Trump's predecessors, George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Perhaps above all, the ban showed that in the American system, it is still possible to codify racism into law. The Supreme Court reversed a series of lower court decisions which allowed the ban to go into effect. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Slim hopes of progress towards peace in Yemen were swiftly dashed this month as former US President Donald Trump designated Yemen's Houthi Ansarullah movement as a foreign terrorist organization before he left office. A move widely condemned as deeply damaging to the peace process and pushing the country towards a possible new famine. Amid fears for Yemen's future, I secured an exclusive interview with the foreign minister of the Ansarullah-led government in Sana'a for a response to these disturbing developments.
The U.S. is not an international organization or some kind of an institution that has the right to designate someone as terrorist or not terrorist. The U.S. should always be concerned about its affairs, not trying to be the guardian of the whole world.
The foreign minister explained that he felt the U.S. decision was silly and that Trump was probably paid into making the choice.
I think the Trump administration decision was something paid for, and you will see it in the near future. It's something paid for to say certain things or to take some actions. So again, from our side, we are not concerned about that, and we will not deal with it.
I asked the foreign minister whether Yemen would consider a military response. He warned that if the peace process totally fails, Yemen is strong enough to fight back.
If such peace fails, we are ready for all circumstances, and our choices are wide open. And by the way, we can affect and do what we want. We are so strong to the point that we can change the whole scenario, but we will not do it for the sake of the Yemeni people.
The foreign minister also sent a message to the new U.S. President Joe Biden.
If Biden has the courage, and I think he does, they should make an announcement that this war is over, they stop the support of the Saudis and the Emiratis and any other people involved, and the war will stop, and Mr. Biden, maybe later on, will get the Nobel Prize that Trump was running after. Now Biden should run after it.
It's been reported that Biden's foreign policy team disagrees with the terror designation and that many of Trump's policies will be reversed in quick succession. But even if the U.S. ends its support for the Saudi coalition's aggression, peace may be unachievable so long as the Ansarullah-held areas are sanctioned. Robert Carter, London.
French President Emmanuel Macron has rolled out issuing an official apology for the atrocities committed by French troops in Algeria. In a statement, Macron's office said there will be no repentance or apologies for the occupation of Algeria or the deadly eight-year war that ended 132 years of French rule in the North African country. Algeria has been demanding a formal apology for years for France's colonial-era war crimes. The French presidency, however, said France will instead endeavor to face up to its history. The statement comes ahead of the publication of a major government commission report on how France has dealt with its colonial past in the North African country. The report offers proposal to address long-standing grievances, but it skirts the issue of systematic torture by French troops and does not recommend an official apology. France occupied Algeria in 1830. The African country gained independence following the Algerian War of 1954 to 1962. The war is also known as the Algerian Revolution. Algerian historians put the death toll at 1.5 million Algerian victims, while the French historians say around 400,000 people from both sides were killed in the conflict. The truth of the colonization and the War of Independence lay buried for decades. During his presidential campaign in 2017, Macron called the colonization of Algeria a crime against humanity. In September 2018, he officially acknowledged for the first time the widespread use of torture by French forces in the former colony. However, like his predecessors, Macron has so far refrained from issuing a formal apology for his country's colonial past. But grievances tied to the colonial history have weighed on French national integration, since many French citizens are Muslims of Algerian descent. As former Foreign Minister Bernard Kouchner admitted in 2008, there seems to be a permanent contradiction between human rights and the foreign policy of France. The country's dark history of human rights violations and supporting dictators, especially in Africa and West Asia, serves as proof of Kouchner's remark that the French foreign policy is not based on human rights. France's support for former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein during his invasion of Iran in the 1980s, its support for Libya's longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi before his ouster in 2011, and the country's arms sales to Saudi Arabia while the kingdom is involved in the brutal war on Yemen are all indicative of such a policy. It so appears that human rights is only a weapon in the hands of French politicians to target nations that do not get along with their policies.
Democrat Joe Biden has been inaugurated as President of the United States, replacing the highly controversial Donald Trump. As a result of entrenched but minority perceptions of electoral fraud, there was not a peaceful transfer of power. The nation's capital was locked down into a fortress with more soldiers than the U.S. uses to occupy both Afghanistan and Iraq. State capitals were similarly swarming with troops nationwide. The inauguration is being called a merciful conclusion to an electoral campaign which seemingly started the day after the election of Trump in 2016, and then the most divisive vote in recent memory. Biden's inaugural speech spoke often of unity and reconciliation, but Democrats and Republicans seem to have been at each other's throats for four consecutive years. How to turn off this mutual animosity may be the most urgent problem Biden faces, but it may also be the most difficult.
47 years of Biden's being in politics, that he would actually be able to do what's necessary to heal the country. Unless, of course, there's some shift in how he sees it, and unless, of course, there's pressure from the left. Like I said, the role of labor, to actually pressure to actually improve the quality of life of working people.
Biden inherits an America which may be at its lowest point in history. America in 2020 combines 1930s economic depression, 1960s cultural division, 1860s concerns with white supremacy, and 1780s questions of political legitimacy. The coronavirus is killing Americans faster than ever. A highly divisive Senate trial of the recently impeached Trump looms. Gun sales and murder records were recently recorded nationwide, and the country remains on high alert for acts of political terrorism, to name a few of the worst problems.
If we're not talking about enacting changes could improve the quality of life immediately, materially, for working people, And I don't think that they'll be able to heal. And I'm talking about, like, Biden is talking about a return to normal. Well, what's normal?
Both Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are considered to be on the right wing of the Democratic Party. Biden's cabinet is filled with holdovers from the era of Barack Obama, during which Biden was the vice president. Kamala Harris has become the highest ranking woman ever in American history. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Ansarullah Political Bureau has issued a statement to condemn the U.S. designation of the movement as a terrorist group. The statement was issued after the measure came into effect on January 19th, the last day of President Donald Trump in the office. In its statement, the movement has underlined the atrocity of the U.S. against the nations resisting its adventurist policies, including Yemen. The statement says the blacklisting of Ansarullah movement reveals that the U.S. plays a key role in Saudi-imposed war against Yemen. it calls the U.S. the major enemy of the Yemeni nation.
The American decision and designation was not surprising to us, as it came at the culmination of the U.S. hostilities against the Yemenis, ongoing on for 6 years by two succeeding American administrations. The American administration is the one who is committing acts of terrorism against the Yemenis, and if it reflects negatively on the Yemeni people, there will certainly be a response determined by the leadership.
The U.S. move has also sparked rage among the Yemeni academics and students who voiced their anger in a protest organized by Sa'a University. The protesters denounced the U.S. policies and its continuing crimes against nations. Who have not bowed to Washington's desires.
The Yemeni people of all groups, especially the academics, stand against this classification and they stand with Ansarullah. The blacklisting will not harm Ansarullah as it did not harm Hezbollah and all other free people in the world. Rather, it may harm ordinary Yemenis only. We reject this decision and refuse to call the Ansarullah movement a terrorist group.
Yemenis are concerned that the U.S. blacklisting of the Ansarullah movement may impact the humanitarian situation in Yemen amid the ongoing war that was launched by the Saudi-led coalition in March 2015. The devastating war has so far killed tens of thousands of civilians and injured thousands of others in Yemen, while displacing millions in the country. Yemenis say the U.S. blacklisting of the Ansarullah movement is an unacceptable move prompted by the Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. They say the move is aimed at putting more pressure on Yemen, already in dire situation from war and the blockade imposed by the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the Past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
In the name of Allah, dear brothers and sisters, salam. So welcome to this program entitled Lantern. As you know, we have an interesting story at the beginning of the program. Today's story is organ donation. One of the richest and most powerful men in Brazil made waves when he announced plans to bury his $1 million Bentley so he could drive around the afterlife in style. He received lots of media attention and was criticized for the extravagant gesture. Why wouldn't he donate the car to charity? How out of touch with reality is this guy? He still went ahead with the ceremony, but there is a twist. Of course, there is. Why else would we be covering this story? To create awareness of organ donation. People condemn me because I wanted to bury $1 million Bentley. In fact, most people bury something a lot more valuable than my car, he said during a speech at the ceremony. They bury hearts, livers, lungs, eyes, kidneys. This is absurd. So many people waiting for a transplant, and you will bury your healthy organs that will save so many lives.
The process begins with an individual or their family agreeing to donate their organs. In most cases, organ donors are patients who've died in hospital, who've been declared brain dead, where all brain activity has definitely and irreversibly stopped. Their organs are then artificially maintained using a ventilator. Organs suitable for this type of donation are the lungs, heart, liver, kidneys, pancreas, intestines, and uterus. Doctors can also remove tissue from corneas, skin, heart valves, veins, arteries, tendons, or bones. Bone marrow can also be transplanted, although it must come from a living donor. The time frame possible between tissue removal and transplantation is as little as 3 to 4 hours for a heart or 24 to 36 hours for a kidney. Transplant material is transported in airtight ice boxes, which must be kept below 4 degrees Celsius. The recipient is chosen according to their compatibility with the donor, regarding blood and tissue type, or a similar morphology or immune system. That's because the introduction of a foreign organ into the body causes the immune system to react as if under threat and attack it. To avoid rejection of the newly transplanted organ, doctors use medicine to suppress the recipient's immune system. Transplants are extremely delicate. The organ is reconnected to the circulatory system and slowly warmed to enable it to function again.
Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bin astain. One of the good and humanistic job that one may do is to dedicate, to sign a contract or a paper or a document that after his or her death, some parts of his body, his or her body, to be dedicated to a patient who needs those body organs. We know that after death, people, that is human beings, after death, they no longer need those body organs. So one of the good ways and good practices is just to sign an agreement or a document or a paper, legally certified, that they are, they give consent to doing this. Now we find that doing this, granting your own body organs, if upon being needed to someone else, would certainly save the life of other people. According to some research studies, this rate or this trend of dedicating one's body organs, to the needy people, has received the attention of all people by around 200%, and this is a high rate. In the world, but medical doctors say that owing to the injuries and accidents that take place, even this rate isn't enough. On a global scale.
The lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
In Iran, some medical doctors believe that people should be instructed and should be encouraged, they should be inspired to do this. But this is by no means, something obligatory. And because of it's being voluntary, nobody can force someone else to sign such an agreement or to accept it, under any kind of pressure. From this perspective, we understand that those people who are eager to give this kind of help after the death, they are actually benefactors, to other people. And this benefit goes to the person who receives this kind of help, help by means of receiving a body organ. When someone may be, in need of receiving it. On the TV, sometimes we witness that, we see that some people say that, their lives have been saved in this way. And we find that by doing this, in this way, not only those people may be rescued, but their families may be rescued from, a deep worry about the fate of the illness of the beloveds. So far as we know, unfortunately, psychological pressure exerted on people may have other feedbacks, may have other consequences, unfavorable consequences, not on the personal level, but on the social, psychological, or sociocultural level. So in order to mitigate the worries of people, they are actually invited to volunteer for being ready that after the death, the body organs, which can be transplanted from the own body to the body of those sick people who would receive them and will be rescued, such people must receive enough encouragement based on religious values or, cultural standards and so on.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong, a world that often lies, cause I don't need anyone.
aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. We follow Javad, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the desert regions in South Khorasan province, an area of vast desert, sand dunes, and aridness as far as the eye can see. But amid what looks like arid wasteland, at first are wonderful and amazing surprises, including canyons, freshwater springs, and traces of past civilizations. But perhaps what is even more amazing, the next part of the program, is that this dry, arid land yields the world's most coveted spice and Iran's prized red gold, saffron.
I leave behind the ruins of Dihuk and its beautiful architecture for my main destination, which is the terraced saffron farms of Esfandiar, a patchwork of little farms that demands the attention of any visitor. The name Esfandiar was derived from the word espand, or wild rue plants that grow in abundance in and around this village. In the spring season, these perennial plants make the mountains surrounding Esfandiar all the more beautiful. In my opinion, this village is a masterpiece, home to many and varied beauties in and around it. The people of Esfandiar are kind, faithful, and hardworking. Farming is the main occupation of the people living in this part of the country, and their main produce is Iran's famed red gold, that is, saffron. The fragrant, vivid crimson threads are known by almost everybody around the world, and has forever been the world's most expensive spice. In the words of researchers, the history of saffron goes back thousands of years. Iran was the first place where these beautiful flowers were planted. And after Iran's neighboring countries such as India, Syria, and Lebanon found out about it, it was also planted in Greece for the first time. The word zafaran is the Arabicized version of the word zarparan, meaning a flower with petals of gold. Saffron threads are plucked from the flower Saffron crocus and used mainly as a seasoning and coloring agent in food. Historically, saffron has been among the most expensive spices in the world. Harvesting saffron is so labor-intensive. Every 150,000 crocus flowers that weigh approximately 75 kilos yields a meager 1 kilo of this sought-after spice. The crocus bulb grows multiple flowers for several years, but after that, the number of its buds decreases by the year. Still, there have been instances where 30-year-old bulbs bloomed too. Around the world, saffron is used as food seasoning, medicine, dyeing agent, and fragrance. At the moment, Iran is the world's biggest producer of saffron, accounting for 90% of the world's production. Saffron has been used as a coloring agent for 50,000 years. Signs of that application have been discovered in drawings found in caves in Iraq and across the Achaemenid Persian Empire. Sumerians used it as medicine and for making certain potions. Iran's South Khorasan province is the main producer of saffron in the country. The reason I've chosen Esfandiar is the many other stunning sights to see apart from the beautiful saffron farms, the beautiful pomegranate, fig, and almond gardens. The lofty mountains behind the village reaching to the skies,
the vast terraced saffron farms and a very hospitable people who are a valuable asset for Iran. Add to that the beautiful ancient village of Esfandiar that has lain uninhabited for around 30 years for fear of earthquakes. Beauties have turned Esfandiar into a peerless little paradise in the heart of the desert. I'm overjoyed at the knowledge that the village has maintained its original shape, everything from the architecture to the farmlands. Thanks to my good friend Abbas Amiri, a village council member and a schoolteacher, and the other responsible inhabitants of the village, no one is allowed to make even the smallest changes to the architecture of the buildings in the village and of those nearby. I hope that the authorities of the Cultural Heritage Organization and the responsible villagers living here will join forces in preserving and renovating the unique architecture of the buildings in Esfandiar, give local and foreign tourists a chance to relish in such a beautiful bucolic environment, and leave a precious legacy for posterity. Additionally, a move like that will help the country's tourism industry to thrive and create jobs for the locals, provided that not a single modern structure is built in this area, and the landscape is clear of paved roads, power posts, and other eyesores. I spend the whole day walking around in the mountains surrounding Esfandiar and taking beautiful photos of the village from different angles. I'm supposed to accompany my good friend Amir, a village council member and high school teacher, and his kindly wife to a saffron farm. I want to see up close how they and other villagers pick the saffron threads. It's freezing. It's 6:30 in the morning, and most of the villagers have already sat down in a squatting position on their farms picking saffron-bearing flowers. I really didn't want to get out of my comfortable bed and come out here in this biting cold and dry weather. But the best time to pick those flowers and to see the farmers at work is the very early cold hours of morning. Apparently, it has to be cold, and it should still be dark when they start picking the flowers. I better get going. Very cold, very. It is mid-fall, and the best time to harvest the saffron. The cold early morning fall weather in the desert is ice cold. Time is of the essence for these saffron farmers, so they have to make the best use of the time they have. From the day when the first saffron crocuses burst into flower, the farmers have around 15 days to pick all of them. Therefore, they cannot wake up anytime they want and go to work anytime they please. There is a certain time during all those 15 days at which the farmers can pick the flowers, and that is only the early morning hours. All the villagers, men and women, young and old, lend a helping hand on the farm during this period. It takes a certain degree of skill to pick the flowers, and the older folks of Esfandiar